How did you discover that your wife was under surveillance by the Division of Homeland Security?
You know, one day she received a phone call from, I believe, a major in the Maryland State Police, informing her that she was invited to come down to Baltimore from New York, where we live, to read her file, which had been illegally gathered on her, at the headquarters of the Maryland State Police offices, after which the file would be destroyed permanently. She was not allowed benefit of counsel to accompany her, and she was not allowed to make any copies or record anything of the files. And as a result of that call, we discovered that she was not alone. There were 53 people who had been illegally spied on for some time at what's probably what's known as, although they never fess up to it, what's known as a fusion center, that is to say, a kind of base within the state or city police forces where Homeland Security kind of does its stuff in terms of domestic spying.
So why was your wife under surveillance?
Well, that's a very funny question. The surveillance itself came about accidentally as the result of a law proceeding regarding, I think there was some kind of demonstration near Fort Detrick, Maryland, which is the home of our chemical and biological warfare research. And as a result of the discovery process there, the ACLU in Maryland had come across evidence that had been provided them, I think, accidentally by the state police and state government, that there was a big spying program going on. And it crossed a wide variety of folks, from anti-war activists, anti-death penalty activists, to pro-life activists and such. It was not just left or right wing.
And your wife had been an anti-war activist.
Yeah, but the funny thing, and this is something that we discovered later on when we actually received some of the documents, long story short, she never ended up going down there, and the ACLU was able to pry copies of the file to get into their victim's hands. And when you saw the file, of course, it was pretty fun to read, because what you were reading was a couple of words surrounded by line after line of just black marker, completely redacted texts. But what you could read would lead you to believe that whoever they were spying on down there in Maryland, where my wife had never set foot except perhaps to put gas in the car on her way to and from New York and D.C., whoever they were spying on was not my wife. Hmm. It was somebody else.
Wait, but her name was on the file, but yes. None of this had anything to do with her?
Well, to the extent to which you could make out what it had to do with, because, of course, when they share your file these days, what they share with you is just a bunch of black lines. but there were enough lines that hadn't been completely blackened out. And you saw things like crime, : terrorism, : animal rights, and things like this. And a few other little bits, tidbits, especially in a section of the file that was entitled narrative. The narrative was about 3 pages, and it was just, again, 90% blacked out lines. But narrative appeared to narrate the spying on somebody who participated in the planning and or a protest in front of Fort Detrick at some point in time, and we're pretty clear, unless my wife does some very extensive sleepwalking and traveling, that she was nowhere near there. So it's a funny story on one hand. Obviously, it's a little scary on the other, because on the one hand, you don't want to be illegally surveyed and spied on by your government. On the other hand, if they're going to do it, you expect at least a modicum of competency.
Right.
That didn't appear to be the case here. And it was also got me thinking about some of my favorite moments in movie history. For example, the plot of Alfred Hitchcock's great film starring Cary Grant, North by Northwest, where you recall Cary Grant plays an advertising agency executive who is mistakenly taken for secret agent George Kaplan. And the Russian spies are therefore hot on his tail and want to kill him. And when he finally catches up with the FBI to try to figure out what's been happening, it's explained to him, of course, that George Kaplan doesn't exist. He was made up by the FBI to lure these evil spies.
And so inadvertently, he becomes a spy throughout the course of the film.
He becomes George Kaplan.
Right.
So to the extent to which one has a file And the file is essentially a bunch of blacked out lines. One becomes a terrorist.
So your wife is a terrorist?
Absolutely.
So there's no evidence at all that anything in this file had anything specifically to do with her?
Not that we could tell, no.
How bizarre.
It is and it isn't. I think when you look at the way in which post 9/11 the federal government and state and local governments have dealt with the need, both perceived and real, to collect intelligence, so-called, on us folks, you find some pretty funny stories pretty quickly. The late Senator Ted Kennedy, of course, had a hard time actually flying for a while because he was put on the no-fly list, or somebody named Ted Kennedy was. And when you're Ted Kennedy, that's a pretty funny place to be, as you can imagine. What happens is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of names get sucked into what's known as TIDE. It's not a detergent, although you could think of it that way. It's an acronym for the Terrorist Identity Database Environment. And there is no one list anywhere. There's just a bunch of lists that get kind of blended and parboiled and mixed up together and used in different ways. And so the great fear, of course, for the people who had been spied on in Maryland when it was discovered was that their files would be, in fact, destroyed, but the fact that their files existed would still remain in the terrorist identification database environment. And that would be then even doubly damning because they were so guilty that their files were so top secret that nobody could find them. Hmm. So it was quite important, in fact, to preserve these documents. Hmm.
Now, you wear several hats as you approach the story. One is, of course, as the husband of your activist wife. You are also the head of a movie studio, and you are a professor who teaches narrative theory. And I know that's part of your interest in this whole story. And you have made the very provocative claim that what the Homeland Security does is they tell stories with these kinds of files. In fact, you have said they are part of the greatest narrative-producing machine ever assembled.
Well, you have to understand at this point, millions of our fellow Americans have top security clearances now. It's a gigantic industry that encompasses the CIA, the FBI, all of these state intelligence units and city ones. We know that New York City police, for example, have a gigantic spying apparatus that extends and radiates far outward from New York City. They were just caught out by the Associated Press, actively spying in places like New Haven, Connecticut, New Jersey, and elsewhere. So there's this huge apparatus out there. The biggest piece of it of all is probably the NSA, and they're building one of the largest kind of data processing centers in the kind of the known history of. Certainly, it's going to be it's a gigantic football field after football field after football field sized site out in Utah. But there's all kinds of places from Maryland and Georgia to Utah, California, everywhere, all over the country, and hundreds of thousands of people work in these factories, scooping up more or less everything, every piece of electronic communication that they can get their hands on. And it feeds into a vast sorting and data collection apparatus that has been increasingly part of our experience as consumers and citizens. Anybody who goes on Facebook and downloads an app of any kind more or less is granting the people who are providing that app with enormous amounts of their own personal data, but more importantly, the data of all their friends and contacts listed in their phone book, et cetera.
So all this personal data is being collected. That doesn't necessarily mean this is storytelling.
Exactly. And that's the big problem, of course, for the NSA and for the other spies. You now have this sea of data, but you need to narrativize it. You need to look at the data and find patterns that are suspicious enough to you that they become meaningful, right? And that's a big problem. You know, before 9/11, of course, the NSA clearly and the spy, probably some other pieces of the spying apparatus, had plenty of the chatter that al-Qaeda had sent out through the via telephone and internet. They just couldn't make that chatter actionable. They couldn't figure out what the story was, or they weren't paying attention. There was so much that it got lost in the pile. So the big task for all of these folks who work within this industry is to create stories out of just terabyte after terabyte after terabyte of data. it's probably not a coincidence that one of the key players in building up of this new industry for the NSA, for example, happened to work at Disney's Imagineering Labs. And you find that again and again. How do you take all this stuff, even what's known as in our daily lives, exhaust data? You know, every time you go online and do a Google search, every time you buy something online, every time you use your charge card at the pharmacy, every time you use your phone. Of course, that was the funny thing that happened last year when Apple, after years and years of saying that they did not have geo-tracking code implanted in the iPhones, had to fess up. Somebody figured it out and fessed up. So really, anywhere you go, everywhere you walk with your phone on, you're being tracked. You're creating data. And so the interesting thing about that is even a normal American average Joe citizen is just generating huge amounts of data every day, whatever you do. And the interesting thing is, of course, what happens is what becomes increasingly suspicious and why narrative, the document that we came across, seems an emblem for all this, is that what's interesting about that document is all the blacked out lines. Mm-hmm. If your friends knew that you had a bunch of documents sitting there in the files of Homeland Security, and they were only accessible in a process that would lead them to be produced for you and your friends as just a bunch of blacked out lines, you immediately become quite suspicious. In fact, that's the story. The story is you're somebody who's got a file.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what's under it. And think about this. There may be nothing under those lines. Maybe it was an empty white page, and it just makes it look more suspicious if you put the black lines on it. So it's actually the gaps and the cover-ups and all the evasions that actually create the story now. Mm. We're all so much part of this electronic environment of data production. And so you can imagine, for example, there's a ton of software out there right now where you can track your kids, right, on their cell phones or your mate. You can do geo-tracking with a little device that you just stick under the car, for example. There's all kinds of ways in which this has become the norm. And just imagine if, in fact, you have one of those pieces of software and your partner, wife, spouse knows about it and whatever. What happens if one afternoon they just turn it off for 3 hours?
So going back to...
Exactly.
The movie that you mentioned, Hitchcock's North by Northwest, this is more than just... It sounds like more than just sort of a clever film association here. I mean, you're actually kind of serious that there are things to learn from the way Hitchcock created stories to how we might interpret something like what you're just describing?
The famous thing about Hitchcock when you study film history and theory, of course, is the MacGuffin, right? Everybody talks about this all the time. All of his greatest films and most entertaining ones have at their heart the MacGuffin, which is, of course, the completely meaningless, who cares, secret mystery that everybody's chasing after and always worried about. And that seems to go completely against the grain of every advice anybody's ever been given when they start off as a writer, a narrative writer, author, whatever. You know, write what you know. Write a story. It's got to be blah. It's got to be meaningful. And what Hitchcock proves again and again is you can have the most intense narrative experience and walk out of the theater and go, I have no idea what was at stake there. You know, there's no stakes. It's a MacGuffin. It's nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a nothing at the core of narrative. And that nothingness is really what Hitchcock plays with to create these very intense stories that we get sucked into. And why is that? A number of reasons. One is, on the one hand, you have North by Northwest, the story of a guy who's not George Kaplan, who then has to become George Kaplan in order to be killed by the people who want to kill George Kaplan. Mm-hmm.
Right? So they have to fake his death.
Yeah, yeah. Or remember, the American spies actually don't really care that much. They're like, well,
right,
if he gets killed, at least
right,
we'll catch
exactly.
The spies.
You know, right. A casualty. During the job.
Yeah. So he has to kind of go on the run from everybody.
Right.
You have the flip side of Hitchcock, which is probably a movie that's not as well known, but kind of just as much fun, called The Man Who Knew Too Much. And he actually made this – he liked this movie so much he made it twice, right? And The Man Who Knew Too Much, of course, a similar story. A guy just by accident meets up with a mysterious stranger who ends up getting a knife in the back. But as the mysterious stranger is dying, he says something to our guy. He whispers in his ear. And now our guy knows too much. What is it? It really doesn't matter, right? Of course not. But the fact for Hitchcock is that whenever you know anything is always too much. And the reason for that is very, very simple. Because we tend to, in normal everyday use, think of knowing something as a very simple thing. It's that there's a thing and you know it. But actually, as human beings, it doesn't really work that way. The fact is, if it's knowable, right, if something is knowable, that means it's communicable, right? You can't really know something unless it's something that somebody else could know too. Mm-hmm. It's not really a truth or a fact if it were only yours. You can have a feeling, you know, somebody can, you know, prick you with a pin and you can have some pain. That's yours, but that's not really knowledge, right? Things that you know are things that actually can be passed all around and communicated. And so by their very definitions, things that are known are always things that can, and in fact, in some ways, are already known by other people. And hence, in a lot of contemporary psychology and psychoanalysis, you know, since Freud, the very structure of knowledge itself takes on the structure of paranoia. Because if you know it, it's only because somebody else knows it too, right? Mm-hmm. The only way you know something is to know something that somebody else knows. And therefore, the only way you know something is to be, to a certain extent, under the very suspicious that you know something, somebody else knows it, they know it about you, et cetera, et cetera. The very structure of knowledge depends on other people.
This is a very paranoid view of the universe. Yes, here.
Absolutely. But the fact is, the paranoia in a very technical sense. To give me one piece of knowledge you have, which is yours alone, right? Mm-hmm. And the minute you try to think of it, it starts to get a little paranoid. Well, am I really the only person who knows that? And this goes way back in Western theology, even in Western philosophy. You look back even to, you know, great philosophers and theologians like Bishop Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And his argument was pretty, in some ways, very simple, but actually quite complicated, which is the only thing that exists is a thing that's observed. If it's not observed, it really doesn't exist. You know,
if the tree falls in the forest and no one's there, did it really happen?
Yeah. Or in that case, they talk about the sound, right? Because, of course, sound is this relational thing about the vibrations hitting something that can record it. But to a certain extent, that's true. And Berkeley's argument out of this, or into it, he actually had perversely turned it into an argument for the existence of God. Because humans have very limited sensibilities, sensoriums, can't see everything. But you instinctively know that, you know, even if it wasn't, you didn't see it or somebody else didn't see it, it happened. And that's because, of course, God sees everything. And that's really your guarantor that, yes, what you're experiencing or seeing or even thinking is real because God sees it. So again, it's a hyper-paranoid view that goes into even the substratum of thinking in kind of, you know, the last few hundred years about God. Himself.
So we were talking about film, and you mentioned Hitchcock films. Do you see this sort of model of narrative of keeping certain things hidden? I mean, is that sort of a trope in a lot of cinema?
Well, it's not just in cinema. It's in all human storytelling. And you should think about it this way. Who are your favorite storytellers and who are your least favorite storytellers? Your least favorite storytellers tend to be those of your companions who you're sitting there having a beer with, and they say, a really funny thing happened to me today. First I got up, then I brushed my teeth. It happened to me in mid-morning, and then I got dressed. Well, no, I showered, and then I got dressed, and I had breakfast. Did I have I had some oatmeal with some fruit. Yeah, I had that. I was running a little late, so I didn't read the paper. And they tell you everything. In other words, these are not good storytellers. People who tell you everything are just, they're not really storytellers. Storytellers are those who withhold the information that's not necessary to generate the narrative effect they're trying to give off. So it turns out that the art of storytelling, the art of narrative itself, is the art of precisely of that gap, of that redaction. It's precisely the story of what's not being told. And we pay good money to be lied to have information withheld from us, to be fooled again and again, or at least to pretend that we're being fooled. You really don't want to go to a movie where the filmmakers are telling you everything. Mm-hmm. You'd be checked out after a couple of hours and bored witless. Mm-hmm. What you want to be is fooled, and that is, say, important information that the storytellers could have told you all along, but it just happens to be the most fun to find that out 5 minutes before the end of the movie when you realize the guy you thought was the good guy turns out to be the bad guy or blah, 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 blah.
So you're saying a lot of the pleasure of going to see a movie is trying to figure something out or having it revealed to you.
Yeah, I would say, you know, and there are many, many different accounts of this, and people value the way they value the narrative machine changes the way they describe why you like stories and what they're good for. And there's all kinds of now cognitive and evolutionary theories about narrative and all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it isn't even necessarily the case that you like to go figure things out. You know, a lot of people go to a movie and will say, oh, that was too much work. You know, on the other hand, so it may not be that you actually want to figure it out, but you do kind of want to pretend that you're shocked, amazed, you know. And in our culture, we even perversely extend this to the value proposition of going to a movie. The last thing in the world we want is somebody to, quote, give the ending away. Now, in most other parts of our life, somebody said, I'm going to give you a new, you know, Mercedes Benz. You'd say, wow, that's really cool. I would really like that. I'm going to give you a free dinner. That's great. I'm going to give you the story of the movie that you're about to pay $10 for. No. Please, no spoilers. So clearly something about giving, let's say, taking the value proposition down to zero and saying, hey, it's free. Come on, take it. No, I don't want it. And Americans are very insistent on this idea that the one thing they've got to pay for is to pretend that they don't know that at the end of Mission Impossible 4, Tom Cruise will still be alive. You know, really? You didn't quite figure that one out when you got in there? I mean, they're literally going to just like run him over with a truck at the end mm-hmm. of the movie? No, come on. But this is very, very important for us.
Hmm. Let me switch the discussion in a slightly different way, because, I mean, one thing that's so striking about your biography is that you're the CEO of a film company, of Focus Features, and you have a PhD. You teach this kind of stuff. You've been talking about narrative theory. You're an intellectual in the movie industry, which I'm assuming is a pretty rare thing, especially for someone who is an executive in the movie industry.
Yeah, well, you know, you're definitely feeding into a lot of stereotypes there that I'm not going there.
Are those accurate stereotypes?
Yes. You know, the funny thing is, and I can even talk about my colleagues in the more studio side of the mm-hmm. the business. I happen to get to play in the specialized or art house sphere, so we can maintain a sufficiently high level of pretension, even if we have a title of CEO. But what you do notice about when you go to L.A. and visit the Hollywood studios is most of the executives, aside from being insanely hardworking because it's such a competitive space, are pretty voracious in their interests. They have to be, quite frankly. They've got to keep their they got to keep tuned in a sense.
So these are not just people sort of rubbing their palms together, you know, trying to generate money. I mean, they have to be smart.
I mean, look, it's the alchemy that goes into managing from soup to nuts this kind of industrial strength narrative, which Hollywood has successfully for over a century delivered to the world, requires skill sets that are pretty tough. Actually, so I'm always surprised. I'll go into somebody's office, and again, it may be just set dressing, but there's the London Review of Books, there's stuff that's floating around, which is not to say that the commissary, at the whatever lot, people are going to be at lunchtime are going to be heavily debating social construction versus deconstruction or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not the case at all.
Does your scholarly background, the fact that you've studied a lot of this stuff, does that inform your work at all as a movie executive?
It probably does. But at the same time, it's 3 o'clock. We have to make the decision on whether to give a percentage of adjusted gross contingent compensation to an actor in order to close a deal for our next movie. It's at those moments that I'm probably not reaching for my Sergei Eisenstein.
Now, you are very well known, among other things, for your collaboration with Ang Lee, the film director of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Brokeback Mountain, lots of other movies. And you've collaborated on, what, 10 movies with him?
Yeah, I think
like
it's 10 or 11, but I'm not keeping track either.
You've written some of the screenplays or co-written screenplays. Mm-hmm. You've produced all of them, is that right?
Yeah, or in some version of producing or executive producing. Yeah, it's been mm-hmm. fun. Aang is now working on the first film in 20 years that we haven't worked on together, which has been a blast. He's making an adaptation of The Life of Pi for Fox. It's a big, big movie, 3D effects, gigantic production. And it's been really fun, I have to say, being able to talk to Aang and not having it be work, because he's actually really funny and fun. So, and visiting a set that I had nothing to do with, and I could, you know, there they are. Oh, the day's running late. It's costing money, and I'm over there by the craft services table, you know, having a snack.
So, putting aside that movie, but the movies that you've worked on with him, how would you describe your the nature of your collaboration?
You know, I think like any healthy collaboration, it changes not only over time, but also according to the dictates of the specific job and the project. On some films, I'm really at a granular level involved in the decision-making and discussion and testing and pushing and cajoling and kvetching and all that kind of stuff. And on other films, even the ones that I've written or co-written, I sometimes feel as if, you know, my job has been to kind of set the stage, set the table. Here are the elements. Here's the dishes. Go make a meal.
You're talking about your role as producer, basically.
Yeah.
So sort of giving him the tools to work with as the director.
Absolutely. So it really has varied from film to film. It's and there's nothing set at the beginning of any of these adventures that says what the role should be, except there's a bottom line. As a producer, you do have to create an environment for your talent to feel confident that they can you know, pursue their passion and do it in a way that's economically within the constraints that you guys have all agreed on. And things change and emergencies come up and you have to think on your feet, but that's that shouldn't be the dominant piece of the of what you do as a producer.
Can I ask a really stupid question?
I'll give you a stupid answer. This is great.
What does a producer actually do? I mean, I assume part of it is, you know, getting the money together, hiring the director. But what's the essence of what a producer does?
Well, I think the essence is what I just said. That is to say, bringing to bear to any particular film the resources, financial, material, creative, and the context. Is this the right studio? Is this the right budget? Are these the right people? Is this the right marketing plan? So, you know, producers should be able to have a say in or a piece of, if not be the driving force for, everything from soup to nuts, finding the underlying material, hiring a writer, putting the right director on the project, making sure the cast is appropriate, raising the money, being an interlocutor, an interface with the studio. Really helping organize the physical production, if not being the actual line or physical producer. It depends. Some of those skills, many great producers I know have those skills also. You certainly have to know how to read a schedule and a budget and make those kind of crucial decisions on the ground. Post-production these days is infinitely more complex than it used to be with the rise of digital media and the ability to make changes, you know, throughout the entire process.
Do you do focus groups with viewers?
At the end of the editing process, so at least the picture editing process, as you're starting sound and music, it's often a good time to put a movie in front of audiences. At Focus, we features the kind of movies we make, you know, Milk and, you know, upcoming Paranorman or Moonrise Kingdom. These are not movies that necessarily require focus group testing of the same way as a studio film, which has to appeal to everybody in the world. But we often find that just simply having our filmmakers watch their films with a recruited audience, you know, in Las Vegas or in Kansas City, outside of New York. We go to all different kinds of places, often Washington, D.C., we're down in a lot. That experience is often a really good one. It's very bracing. You know, it can be very lonely in an editing room for a director and an editor. It's a small, enclosed, dark space. And people tend to start acting the way people do in small, enclosed, dark spaces and places like prisons.
So do the filmmakers typically go back and reshoot some scenes or re-edit the film?
Certainly, I wouldn't say either reshoot or re-edit, but they continue editing afterwards. And, you know, these can be, you know, some directors find the process painful and unnecessary. Others find it painful but illuminating. With us at Focus, we don't, we're not numbers driven. We don't need the film to test in the top two boxes, as they say, you know, as get big numbers and the, you know, definite recommend.
But I'm assuming you do need to make a profit.
We need to make a profit, but the relationship between those numbers and the testing and the eventual performance of films for films like ours is actually quite a bit of a puzzle. It's, in fact, an interpretive puzzle. Because when you're making a movie on a lower budget, you're making a movie for specific target audiences that can be appealed to in different ways. So, you know, a lot of times certain people might be turned off by the film, but those are the people you want to be turned off by the film. You don't really...
give me an example of that.
Well, I would say, to give you an example, one of the lowest testing films in my career was The Ice Storm, a film I made with Aang quite some time ago.
Based on a novel by Rick Moody.
Exactly. And the numbers were just terrible. A lot of that was because the film's tone was so original for the time. And remember, these people were coming off of the street. They just were read a brief description of the film, and they were told that it was free, right? And that's quite different. By the time we got to the Cannes Film Festival, where the film did very well, and then we're able to go into general release, and there were reviews of the film. Reviewers appreciated the film a lot, and they were able to explain to people, wow, check this out, because it's kind of weird, and da-da-da. Well, just that little bit of information, then people adjusted their expectations. They adjusted them, saying, I'm going into something that's out of the ordinary. It's going to challenge me a bit, but I'm ready for that. It makes a world of difference. So when you're doing kind of Rise of the Robo Transformers 5 and recruiting for that, the audience has a very definite understanding of what the film is going to be about and what it's going to feel like before they walk in. They don't need to see an ad or read a review. Certainly they're not reading reviews. And when they walk in for those test screenings, they've got a paradigm that they're judging the film against, and it's appropriate. And therefore, the numbers are going to be much more reflective, probably, of what the eventual film should be.
Do you usually have a pretty good guess as to how well one of your movies is going to do at the box office?
No. I mean, weirdly, I would say, let me rephrase, no. Weirdly, sometimes I do, but I always leave room for just tremendous surprise in both directions. You just never know. The movie gods speak in way too many languages. Most of them are not understandable by human beings. And that's part of the fun and part of the scariness of being in the business.
Now, some of the movies we've mentioned, for instance, the Ang Lee movies, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, The Ice Storm, those, I guess, would qualify as art house movies. But they had a fair amount of commercial appeal, too. Is that I'm assuming that's kind of the territory you like to work in.
It is. My own personal tastes veer from the extreme avant-garde to the absolute popcorn. But for professional life and kind of affinity for the kind of storytelling I like to see and work on, we tend to focus to deal with filmmakers who speak a language basically anybody can understand. There's, you know, it's a cinematic language that's very accessible, but they're saying new and different stuff often. And so on the one hand, they'll stay in the art house and speak very well to that. On the other, they're speaking to everybody, and sometimes we have those surprising crossover hits, you know, the Lost in Translations, the Brokeback Mountains, the Milks, where it's not that they became more commercial. It's simply that the culture at large kind of caught on to the conversation in a way and really took it seriously and enjoyed it.
Hmm. Well, tell me about one of those. That it sort of became part of the cultural conversation, Brokeback Mountain. How do you account for that? Because it did, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is the hard work that, as a distributor, you put into laying track and marketing and publicizing. A lot of it has to do with the million accidents that add up into a wonderful film. You know, everybody's trying their best to make great films, and sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes it works out. Sometimes it works out, but in such a way that at the moment you go into release, it's just not – the critics, for whatever reason, didn't respond, and – you hope 10 or 20 years from now, it'll be like, yeah, they didn't get it then, but now they get it. Or maybe you just made a movie that didn't work, and 10 or 20 years from now, it's not even available on Netflix, and nobody's ever heard of it and never will. You never know. You really never know. But one of the things you do is you try your best, at least I do, as a marketer and distributor, to make sure that the movie that you're selling is the movie you're delivering. I don't like to cheat. So the first thing is what you're really trying to do is to provide a language to people who are experiencing the movie that they can then express that experience to their friends positively and with conviction.
That's when you say provide a language, you're talking about in the marketing of it?
Yeah, to a certain extent. You know, a frame that says, here's a discussion that we're starting with you, and you can take the language any way you want. You can pick it up and move it. I mean, Brokeback Mountain is a perfectly good example of a film that was a laughingstock all the way through pre-production, production, post-production in the industry. It was the gay cowboy movie. But when it finally...
And it's inspired all of these parodies. since.
Oh yeah, no, it's probably the most parodied movie I know of. At the time. And by the way, the parody wasn't of the movie; it was of the trailer.
Hmm.
And that was really interesting to me because the trailer, when we got around to cutting the trailer, we realized that rather than go for the gay cowboy movie, what we wanted as our paradigm was the great romance. And it was gay, obviously. I mean, these guys are hugging each other and saying, I wish I knew how to quit you, and it's all music is swelling. We said, let's not be apologetic. Because this movie is essentially a star-crossed lovers movie. And people who love star-crossed lovers movies tend to be women. And although you would think your first and primary audience is the LGBT audience, and indeed they were absolutely the early adapters, and we did not take them for granted. We made sure that we did enormous amounts of outreach to those communities. The vast bulk of our marketing materials and our marketing dollars were spent reaching out to women. And this is the early days of internet market research and advertising. We actually had the idea to research the sites that women went on to, but certain women. We wanted to know women who volunteered, for example, more than 1 hour a week.
Hmm.
They could be religious, they could be lefties, they could be both. But what we wanted was people who were empathetic and were acting on that empathy. Because we knew that our trailer would trigger the kind of empathetic stuff. And we bought very heavily on those sites, and we made sure we bought it to so that people could click through to very rich media. At the time, it was again, this is all kind of new. Now it feels so quaint.
Is it more of a science now, or if not a science, more of a formula for how to market a movie?
I think all marketing these days is scrambling to catch up with, quite frankly, exactly what we were speaking about earlier. And that is the vast amounts of data that are available about people and their friends, their social networks, and what it means. I mean, the fact is, if you're somebody who goes online and is really interested in gay cowboys, sure, that's pretty obvious. Okay, I'll sell you a gay cowboy movie. I mean, but it ain't quite that simple, especially when you're trying to market a cultural phenomenon, let's say. And the fact is, you're seeing this debate play out recently with the surprise success of the novel 50 Shades of Grey.
Mm-hmm. The erotic novel.
The erotic novel, but it's actually an erotic romance, which people always seem to forget. And you're now getting all these so-called thought pieces, one recently in Newsweek, which is like, oh, women who are now so powerful in real life are succumbing to fantasies of being powerless, and this book is showing them blah, 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 blah. And, it's always tempting to come up, and I'm sure you've had many guests who've more than given in to this temptation of coming up with these grand contemporary sociological analyses of,
mm-hmm,
culture,
sure,
and what's going on. But you just want to say, wait a second, there's got to be an explanation. I'm ready to see it. But it may well be, and your explanation may well be true, but then does that mean that when hundreds of millions of dollars are made in the first weekend with a movie with a bunch of teenagers running around killing each other means that teenagers just want to kill each other? maybe, mm-hmm, especially if her leg is on my side of the back seat or whatever. But I don't think so. I think fantasy and culture work in far more complicated and interesting ways. And so the idea that there's instant gratification in one's analysis of this particular cultural product, or not, it just seems silly to me.
What makes a truly satisfying movie experience for you? Not as a viewer, but as someone who works in the industry who makes movies. When do you feel really good about what you've done?
Well, look, Focus Features, we're just celebrating our 10th anniversary, which is it's a lot of fun to look back. I don't, but not too much. I am not that nostalgic a person. But one of the things I think we're most happy about is that if you go online or Allah willing, you walk into a Blockbuster, I don't know, I guess there's a couple, and you try to look for the director's cut of one of our movies, from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind to The Pianist, to Brokeback, to Coraline or Burn After Reading or This Serious Man or any of them, you'll never find it. You'll never find a director's cut of any of our films because every film we've released has been the film. At the end of the day, by hook or by crook, sometimes the director has said, "That's my movie." And so to me, that's a lot of fun because we are a studio. And so, yeah, you want to make movies that work for the public that you're making them for. And you have opinions and there's a sometimes spirited debate and discussion. But it's great to have been at the helm of a studio for a decade where we know that every film we've released has been a film that's at the end of the day is really the vision of its primary artistic mover and shaker. And we have great screenwriters and producers and actors, but I think the directors are still the center of what we do for a number of reasons. And to know that they have been well served by us is a nice thing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was great. Thanks.